come here to Juventus in our opening game of the Champions League and play like we did, second half was extraordinary. Extraordinary. And we've gone and got a decision like that there. It's absolutely extraordinary. We were magnificent, magnificent. Coming roaring in there against Juventus, who spent £100 million, and we were fantastic.
Gap looks up. Perfect cross to the back post, and it's Thompson. Alan Thompson has fired Celtic ahead, as he did in Stuttgart earlier in the year.
2-0 to Celtic! Absolutely sensational! Plays it into Nakamura! Left side Nakamura! What a shot that is! Shot it again! Finishes it off! What a night at Celtic Park! That goal was simply majestic!
Is that actually small Guru across? Well, Guru, left foot in corner, in towards the far post, header in!
I'm joined now by the human torpedo. We have been talking on Twitter and had an article on the site that this is podcast number 200. And to commemorate the fact that we're doing 200 podcasts, it's actually started by an idea by the human torpedo when he and I were debating back and forth about creating an all-time 11 and the challenges of an all-time 11 team. In terms of being able to say that you'd seen this player or that player. And I think the example I gave on the site was, I've never seen Jimmy Johnson, I've never seen Jimmy McGrory, I've never seen Patsy Gallagher or many others in the flesh. So how can I possibly say that they were better or worse than Paul McStay, who I did see, who was fantastic, but Paul McStay played on better pitches with a better ball, with better quality boots than those players did, and then modern players today, and so on and so on. So we were debating what we could do, and then Celtic were drawn in the Champions League in a group of champions with AC Milan, Barcelona and Ajax, and it just came to us that perhaps what we can do, and it's in most people's memories, is to pick out the Celtic team and create a Celtic, best Celtic 11 from the Champions League. So, hello Human Torpedo, how are you?
Hello Harry, how are you?
Excellent, thanks. So you have drawn the short straw by being first on and going to talk about a very short list of just five people, and that is the goalkeepers who've represented Celtic in group stages of the Champions League. That's group stages or last 16. It is not the qualifying stage of it, although I think it's the same keepers who've played. So the reason why I chose you is because your work with the Celtic Wiki, obviously the tales in the Celtic Wiki that have been on the Celtic Underground podcast now for 200 on and off for 200 episodes. I chose you because of your fantastic in-depth knowledge and expertise. So have you been reading up on the performances of these five outstanding Hoops goalkeepers?
No.
Yes, we were just discussing before I started recording about how much we were just relying on the other person having done the research to know who was the better keeper or not. So, first of all, there must be three honorary mentions before we get on to the five men who've donned the hoops. And the three honorary mentions are for guys who sat on the bench and have never played in a Champions League game for Celtic, and they are Mark Brown, Dimitri Karin, and Lukasz Soluska. So before we discuss the others, who is the best keeper out of those three who never played in the hoops in the Champions League? Did you go for Mark Brown, Karin, or Soluska?
I think it'd have to be, in terms of performances at Celtic, it would have to be Soluska for me. Karin never really sort of did too much, did he? Mark Brown never really convinced me, so I would have to go with Soluska.
Okay, so Soluska, if we need a sub of players who didn't play, Soluska would be, or if perhaps we need a team of 11 players who turned up for Champions League games but never got on the park, Soluska would be number one choice to be in goals.
Yeah, if I had to pick a player who I didn't want to play, it would be Soluska.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd be pleased to get that accolade. So the three men we're going to choose from in order of their appearances in Champions League football for Celtic are Rad Douglas, David Marshall, Magnus Hedman, Arthur Boric, and Fraser Foster. For me, it's fairly obvious what it's going to come down to in choosing the goalkeepers, but let's just see. First up, representing Celtic in the first Champions League campaign that we had, which was in the 2001-2002 season, when we had Juventus, Porto, ourselves and Rosenberg were in the group, we had Rab Douglas. So, away you go, human torpedo, and tell me the pros and cons of Rab Douglas as a Celtic goalkeeper.
Douglas, I think I remember when Douglas, when he first came to us, he was obviously highly rated, I think, at the time at Dundee, and Martin O'Neill was putting together his team, and I think it was about 1.5 million we paid for him at the time.
Yeah, something like that.
I think he was sought after by another club who no longer exists as well, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was certainly highly regarded when he came to us, and Martin O'Neill was making signings at that time. I think it was around about the same time he brought Raymond Vega in, about that sort of time he came to us. So you had a lot of faith in O'Neill's signings at that time, and certainly with Douglas, my initial feeling was that it was a solid enough buy. And I think over the years he probably proved himself as quite a solid keeper. And when you look back at his Champions League campaign, I don't think there's any sort of particular horror show you can point a finger at and accuse him of being guilty of. I think he was pretty steady for us at Champions League level. He did have the advantage of having an excellent defence in front of him, with people like Valharin, Baldi, Mialbi. So he had that solid base in front of him. And he was quite a solid, if unspectacular goalkeeper, but he wasn't a goalkeeper who would probably win your games. He was I'm trying not to damn him with faint praise here, but he was a.
You want to say he was solid? You just—it's a phrase that you've used now a couple of times, and it's really about the best. And as you say, it's not a. It's not a criticism, it's just, it's about the best thing you can say about him. He wasn't bad, he wasn't fantastic, He was actually, he was the goalkeeping equivalent, I always felt, of Stephen McManus.
Yeah. It was, we've always had a peculiar relationship between the Celtic support and keepers, really, haven't we? We've never sort of, you know, probably prior to the era we're discussing, you could probably count on one hand the number of keepers who in a century or more have probably been held in real esteem by the support. If you look at people like Davy Adams, Johnny Thompson, Willie Miller, Ronnie Simpson. I'm not saying we've not had other good keepers, but there's only a very few who've been held with the same reverence as a lot of the outfield players. And Rab Douglas kind of typifies why, really. He was just ordinary.
I always got the impression with Rab Douglas, you know, O'Neill had come in and had spent money. He bought Chris Hutton for £6 million. He'd spent big on John Hartson. As you say, he went and got Ramon Vega, and he'd obviously brought in Val Haren and Neil Lennon. And he was perceived as... It was perceived that we were certainly starting to move towards going down the Rangers route of signing big name players. And I specifically remember Hugh Keevans in particular going on and on and on about, you know, we were rumoured to be after this player or that player. And Hugh Keevans seemed to be going on and on and on about why were we bothering going after this player and that player when Scotland's best goalkeeper was just up the road and we could pick him up for a bargain. And I'm not saying that Martin O'Neill would be browbeaten into choosing a goalkeeper based on what the press told him. But there was a very small part of me that felt as though he was.
Was Douglas, perhaps then, was he a keeper we signed to prevent him going elsewhere?
Well, yeah, because I remember feeling at the time, you know, I actually remember texting or phoning one of my pals when we signed Didier Agat, because Rangers were allegedly interested in Agat as well, and actually phoning up and saying, is this how Rangers fans have felt for the last 10 years? That any time that there's somebody supposed to be quite good that they're that we were interested in, they just went bottom. It was almost as if we were doing the exact opposite. A player that they were allegedly interested in, so we just went out and bought. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it might have been as much about, well, he seems a decent enough player, he's quite steady, and, well, he'll do the job for me.
Was he an upgrade on Jonathan Gould?
I think he was just different to Jonathan Gould. I think he was more... Jonathan Gould struck me as a short stopper goalkeeper. And Rab Douglas, I suppose, struck me as being a Martin O'Neill type player. He was big and strong. And you knew what you were going to get out of him most. And he wasn't going to massively let you down on me that often. Although I can think of one or two occasions when he did, but you know, that type of dependable, really big, solid, he's a nice big presence at the back.
And to be fair to Rab Douglas, if you actually look at his Champions League record, I think he played six games in total. And two of them were clean sheets, one against Porto. And I remember the Porto game in particular. I think was that the first home game of that campaign after the Juventus match? Did we play Porto first at Parkhead?
Well, yes, we did. We did. We played. Because if you remember, it's one of my sort of bugbears. You know, I'm sure the people involved won't think it was a major bugbear. But we were supposed to play at home first. And September 11th happened.
That's right.
And so we then, our first game was away to Juventus. Mm-hmm. So, and yes, so our first home game in Champions League football was at home to Porto. And we won 1-0. And Big Rab obviously kept a clean sheet.
And if I remember rightly, I think towards the end of the game, I can't remember, it might have been Deco, and I can't remember who the other player was, but there was a couple of chances for Porto towards the end of the game where Douglas, to his credit, pulled off a couple of saves, which made sure we had the 3 points. So I think we might have been doing a bit of a disservice earlier in terms of sort of the faint praise, because I do remember him sort of saving a couple towards the end of that game. Rosenborg, another clean sheet as well. So
yeah, I mean, one of the things that I did think about Big Rab that was a big positive about it. My biggest criticism of Rab Douglas was he didn't use his feet very well. And so if you can, you know, if he dived, it was pretty much from a standing static position. You know, mm-hmm. his feet wouldn't move, and it was really just stretching as far as you could. And, you know, I'm over-dramatising this description so you can understand the point I'm making. But imagine he stretched up as far as he could and then just fell in a straight, just fell left or fell right. There was no spring. That's the point I'm making. He wasn't on, like, I always liked Shea Given, because he was on his toes as a goalkeeper and was ready to come out when he needed to. And we always felt Douglas was quite flat-footed, and there was no spring. He wasn't in the balls of his feet, and there was no spring in his knees.
You wouldn't describe him as athletic, would you?
No, you wouldn't. So that was my slight issue with him. And obviously, you rightly point out that the first two, I mean, obviously we had the 3-2 away defeat to Juventus where, well, obviously they cheated. Yeah. And then we had the two clean sheets against Porto and Rosenborg, which are probably vital in us getting the confidence of playing at Champions League level.
Yeah.
To play these teams who, you know, both Rosenborg, if you remember at the time, Rosenborg and certainly Porto. But Rosenborg had pretty good Champions League pedigrees at that time of playing on a regular basis.
And those two results certainly set out our stall in terms of Celtic Park being a difficult place to come to and get a result. Because, as you say, both of them were quite established at that level. And they both came to Celtic Park, both left with defeats and both failed to score. So Douglas deserves credit for his role in that.
Yeah, but of course, we also in that first Champions League year saw the start of the catastrophic away form that we had in European football in the Champions League. You know, obviously our first away game was unlucky when we lost 3-2 to, and it should have been a 2-each game. Our second away game was to Porto, where we lost 3-0.
Yeah.
And one of the things I remember about that game, I don't have a recollection of blaming Rab Douglas. My recollection was being fearful that they would go on to score 6 or 7.
Well, we were 1-0 down after, was it 45 seconds or a minute or whatever it was. They just tore us to shreds when we kicked off. And as you say, I don't think anybody was pointing the finger of blame at Douglas. The whole defence was just static and caught cold. And they just, as you say, it was at 2-0 at half time, but it could have been 4 or 5.
Yeah. It was one of those famous nights when you genuinely were watching the game from through your fingers, because you just thought, we're going to get an absolute doing here. This is going to be embarrassing. And then, of course, probably more disappointing, particularly now with hindsight, when you look at, although they had a record in Champions League football, when you look back at us losing 2-0 to Rosenborg away, and again, it was one of those games where I don't recall at any point during watching that game thinking we were going to get into it. We had a chance.
Again, they killed the game off early, didn't they? It was over before half time, and we never looked like getting back into it. And Douglas was probably as blameless as anyone could be that night, I think.
Yeah, and again, sitting on the bench in both those games was Dimitri Karin. I mean, one of the other things that's clear in this as you go through, obviously we've been talking about Rab Douglas, and he had 6 appearances, and then he was followed by David Marshall, who, we're not talking about UEFA Cup football, but David Marshall came into the team and was playing in as on the back of getting into the team after Douglas got sent off in that UEFA Cup season. But he was a youth player and played his way into the team. And then he played some games and was in and out. And then Magnus Hedman came in. And we had Magnus Hedman in the team for a while. In total, I think he only played about 22 games for Celtic. Actually, Magnus Hedman played almost 30% of his Celtic career was in Champions League football.
Was it?
But it's symptomatic of many people considering that the one thing that Martin O'Neill couldn't spot was a decent goalkeeper.
See, I remember O'Neill from his Leicester days, where, again, he had signed a couple of keepers who failed to convince. One of them being, actually went on to play for AC Milan, but he bought him at Leicester, Kallak, Australian guy. O'Neill paid quite big money for him and then put him in a game, and he had an absolute nightmare. And the Leicester fans would tell you as well that O'Neill's weak spot was in spotting a decent keeper. And I think that was proven by his time at Celtic as well. It was probably the one position where we had always lacked quality in comparison to the other areas of the field where we had strengthened. And in Douglas and in Hedman, you had players who you'd thought he might be able to get the best out of him, but Hedman was a bit of a disaster, really.
Well, you know, we've talked about Rab, and we don't want to do a character assassination on him, but our next Champions League campaign was 03-04, and Hedman was in the team with Rab Douglas on the bench. And two of the games that I had Celtic fans probably not massive fans of Magnus Hedman were a 2-1 away defeat to Bayern.
Yeah.
And because we were 1-0 up. And I think part of the reason why people were so frustrated at Hedman was there was a cross. My recollection, it was a cross. I mean, obviously, the challenge you got is try as I might, I have been on YouTube to try and download, but obviously UEFA go through and take, because there's a lot of videos that have been taken off, and it says this content has been removed at the request of UEFA. So it's actually quite difficult to go and get historic film of Champions League games, unless you go out and buy the DVDs.
Yeah.
So my recollection of that game is Thompson scored first, and then they made it 1-1, and then with about 5 minutes to go, there was a free kick came in.
I can't remember if it was a free kick or a cross.
Or a cross or something.
Yeah, came and looked harmless enough. And did it bounce and just...
It was one of those ones where, to be fair, it's one of those... My recollection is it's one of those ones that goes across in front of the six-yard... You know, sort of across the six-yard box where if the keeper follows the track of the ball, he should be able to comfortably take it at the back post, but he's going to look like an absolute idiot if he goes to follow the track of the ball and somebody comes to the near post and deflects it in. And there's all these people running towards it. And so the keeper... A bit like Fraser Forster had a similar one against Hearts on Saturday, where the keeper's got to be wary of somebody running in the near post and dinking it in, or the ball just continuing on its path and going through the back post. And Hedman just looked like an idiot.
Yeah.
And it went in, it was 2-1, and he got a lot of criticism for that. But I did feel that a lot of that criticism was just general frustration about the fact that we were 1-0 up with 20 minutes to go, and we were 1-1 with 5 minutes to go.
In slight defence of Hedman, we were, as a team, probably moving into, to use Martin O'Neill's terminology, moving into the the slow lane at that time. I don't think the defence was as good as what Douglas would have had playing in front of him.
No.
That would have been, I think Varga would have played that night. He was a steady enough performer for us, but he would never have got into that defence with Bowdy, Valharan and Mialbi. But I remember rightly that night in Bayern, it was last couple of minutes as well, which just, I think, antagonised matters as well, because, you know, if we'd come away from Munich with a one each.
Yeah, Thompson has scored after 57 minutes at the back post. Ball was swung in at the back post and Thompson had got a header in for that one.
And we'd held our own for the first half quite comfortably, and I don't think we'd look particularly troubled.
No.
And even up to I don't think they equalised until maybe 15 minutes to go. Was it Roy Mackay?
Roy Mackay got both goals for them.
Got both. And I don't think we're particularly troubled. And it was that sense of it being thrown away, I think, which was kind of compounded with criticism for Hedman. Because if you had to blame anyone, it would have had to be him, because you would have expected your keeper to have come in. And even it being an awkward ball into a box, he should have really still came and made that his own.
Yeah, but your point about Celtic moving into slow lane, I think, is best demonstrated. I think this team starts to show that if I had a criticism of Martin O'Neill as well, it was his £4-5 million signings were great. In general, his bargain basement buys were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that in the team against Bayern that night.
Yeah.
That you've Hedman, and I can't remember the exact formation, but if it was three at the back, the three were Varga, Boba Baldi and Jackie McNamara.
I think McNamara was captain that night.
He was. If it was four at the back, then McNamara or Thompson were left back and Didier Gat was right back. So it was, you know, if it was four at the back, but I think at that point he was still playing 3-5-2. So the three would have been Jackie McNamara sitting between Boba Baldi, Stan Varga, Agat on the right, Thompson on the left. And then you were just starting to see that Martin O'Neill system of, I'm going to put down on the team sheet my players that I like best, and then I will work out a formation that fits them, because it's Chris Sutton, John Hartson, Neil Lennon, Henrik Larsson, Stelian Petrov.
Yeah.
So you had that Sutton playing in midfield thing.
Yeah.
You had Hartson and Larsson up front, and you had Neil Lennon. And I think if you want, your point about the slow lane is probably best summed up by looking at our substitute bench. Michael Gray, Momo Sylla, Bobby Petter, John Kennedy, Liam Miller, Sean Maloney.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not being overly critical in terms of Maloney, Kennedy and Miller were kids.
Yeah. Bobby Petter was on a downward spiral by that point.
Yeah, Bobby Petter was that round about the time where Bobby Petter signed a new contract and then was never seen again?
I think it was, yeah. Yeah. And then Momo Sylla was Momo just Sylla. A strange point.
Yes, it was Momo Sylla. It's probably the best way to put it. And then probably one of the real, despite the quality of team that we are just decrying, we still were getting the results at home. You know, we beat Lyon 2-0, and we talked about this before we came on. We lost 1-0 away to Anderlecht, and they were 10 men after 26 minutes. But you know, I don't specifically recall being frustrated at Hedman that night against Anderlecht, but. We then beat Anderlecht comfortably 3-1 at Celtic Park and drew 0-0 with Bayern at Celtic Park. The real thing that got the fans again blaming Magnus Hedman was the 3-2 defeat away to Lyon,
mm-hmm.
where obviously they got the winner with the dodgy handball penalty of Bobo Baldi. But was that not the night where there was a shot that seemed to be going straight at Hedman and then went past him to the side?
I think were we 2-1 up?
We were 2-1 down.
two went down, and had we come back to two each? And then
we came down to two each. So they went one up in the usual first 10 minutes. They scored after 6 minutes. John Hartson equalised in the 24th minute. They made it 2-1 in the 52nd minute, and then Chris Sutton made it two each. And then they got the penalty with the dodgy Bobo Baldi handball.
It must have been their second goal. Was it Janino?
Yes, it was.
It looked like it looked like a pretty harmless long range effort, which just seemed to, I don't know what he was doing, but it just seemed to elude him when it seemed to be quite a stretch.
To be fair, actually, I remember they only showed it once or twice. There was an angle from behind the goal that I recall. If you looked at it, because it was one of these ones where he just sort of stood still. If you looked at it, I'm pretty certain that Janino took a shot, and from behind the goal, it passed. I think it might have even been Alan Thompson who was standing, at the edge of the 18-yard box. It passed over his right shoulder, but went into the back of the net, about 4 yards to the left of his left shoulder. And it had moved around a bit. But I think by that point, people were just starting to... I think he'd had some, I recall a New Year's game up in Aberdeen where he'd gone for a cross and just dropped it at somebody's feet.
Yeah. That was actually quite a horrible campaign, that whole campaign, is when you look at it with the sort of late goal conceded in Bayern. The performance at Anderlecht, where we just seemed to show such a lack of ambition and urgency when they went down to 10 men after 25 minutes. And then with the avoidable second goal for them in Lyon, and the harsh penalty at the end, it was just quite a horrible campaign. I would say Hedman possibly to blame for loss of 2 points, which might have got us into the next
match. Should have got us into it. In fact, I'm pretty certain that's when you had two group stages in the Champions League that season. So we would have actually got through to the second
group stage.
Group stage of the Champions League. Mm-hmm. But we didn't. And Hedman played six games in the 03-04 Champions League season. And then we went, obviously, into the 04-05 Champions League season, where we played six games in total. And we only won one. That was probably our worst Champions League campaign. And Hedman didn't start. We had another keeper in, young David Marshall. And you've got a fantastic stat on young David Marshall's four Champions League games for Celtic.
So I kind of under impression that obviously I think blinded by his performance in against Barcelona for the two UEFA Cup games, that he'd had a good European record with us. And then you actually look back on this campaign, and he actually conceded 9 goals in 4 games. It was actually 9 goals in 3 games until. I think it was the home tie with Shakhtar where we won 1-0.
Yeah.
But prior to that, the opening 3 games of that campaign, was it 3-1 home defeat to Barcelona?
Yeah, our first home defeat in the Champions League, 3-1 at home to Barcelona.
Then it was it 3-1 again at Milan?
Yes, and the Milan game is something that I talked about to Lawrence Donegan in the last podcast that, to this day, grates on me. It was 1 each with... I think it was 1 each with a minute to go, and we got a free kick around about 25 yards from our own goal, facing, obviously it's our free kick, so we're facing upfield, and we lost the game 3-1.
Yeah.
If it had been the other way round, if it was at Celtic Park and it was 1 each and AC Milan had a free kick 25 yards from their own goal facing away with a minute to go in the game, I don't think we would touch the ball again.
No.
But we lost that game 3-1. And their winner was can't remember if it was a winner or was it the second goal to make it 2-1 was a free kick. Certainly, they got the requisite away from home first goal inside 10 minutes when Shevchenko scored after 8 minutes, and then Varga obviously with that free kick made it 1-1.
Yeah,
and you thought, poof, this is it, and we're getting to 2-3 minutes to go, and it's still 1-1, and you thought we're going to get a result, and then Inzaghi scored, and then Pirlo scored,
and then things got worse when we went to the Ukraine.
Yeah, so we went to the Ukraine, and was that pretty much Janino's last game for Celtic when we went to the Ukraine?
Yeah,
one of his last games.
Must have been, yeah.
And Douglas had actually been on the bench for the first two of those games. Rab Douglas was on the bench. So we lost at home 3-1 to Barcelona, David Marshall conceding three. Douglas on the bench. We lost 3-1 at home away to Milan. Marshall and goals and Douglas on the bench. And then we lost 3-0 to Shakhtar Donetsk. But Hedman suddenly reappeared and was on the bench for that one, which must have been an indication of where O'Neill wanted the team to go, because Hedman was then on the bench again for, as you say, we beat Shakhtar 1-0.
Yeah.
But so that was the first game that Marshall played and didn't concede a goal in the Champions League football. Mm-hmm. And then it was Hedman back in.
It's difficult to sort of point the finger at any specific goals. Out of all those nine he conceded, it's difficult to point the finger at any specific goals at Marshall and say, you know, he was at fault for him. But you get that feeling if it had been, for example, a guy we're going to discuss later, or maybe one or two guys we're going to discuss later, we wouldn't have conceded nine goals in those three games.
No.
I
felt that a lot about David Marshall. A bit like we were saying about Rab Douglas, although I would say that Rab Douglas was at fault on more occasions. Maybe not Champions League occasions, but obviously I'm not that confident that he was successful in the UEFA Cup final, and I can think of a couple of howlers against Rangers. Marshall, it was more, I can't think of any glaring error, but as you say, I just don't think we would have conceded those goals if somebody else had been in.
But I guess it's slightly in defence of David Marshall as well. What does it say about the goalkeeping situation at Celtic at that time, that we had two internationals and yet we were going to do a Champions League campaign for the first four games with this young guy who sort of really should have been learning his trade away from that sort of spotlight?
Yeah, I mean, much as we can all have our opinion on Alan McGregor, when Alan McGregor ended up having to be the Rangers goalkeeper, he'd been away at Dunfermline on loan and played first team football. And out of all the positions, goalkeeper's probably the one that you need to learn by playing it.
Yeah.
And as you say, it wasn't Champions League football, but Marshall's first taste of football was Barcelona in the UEFA Cup.
Yeah. And with confidence being such a, it's a key thing for any player, but probably more so for goalkeepers. I'm sure David Marshall himself would have looked back at those first three games and nine goals conceded and must have even been having doubts about himself. I don't think that experience particularly helped his development. And as I say, it's strange that the fact we had two international keepers in the setup, and yet it was on David Marshall's shoulders that the responsibility for those Champions League ties rested.
Yeah, so it's no surprise that was the Champions League campaign where we finished bottom of the group.
Yeah,
we with only 5 points, we had one home victory, and two draws thereafter. Although we did, you know, we went into the last game with a chance of getting in UEFA Cup football, but we didn't.
A clean sheet for Hedman in the last game with the 0-0 draw with Milan.
And much as we've just been talking about Hedman and highlighted the errors against Bayern and against Lyon, and commented about Martin Leo's ability to pick up a keeper. To be fair to Magnus Hedman, he was a Swedish internationalist who'd been playing in the English Premier League or whatever it was called for almost 200 games for Coventry. on the face of it, he was a decent signing.
If I remember rightly, he'd either just lost his place or I think Chris Kirkland was just emerging at Coventry at that time.
Yeah.
And Edmund was probably I can't remember if he was out of a pitch at that time or whether Kirkland had moved on. But I remember he did lose his place at Coventry for a while before he came to us to Chris Kirkland. But I think what sums up, I think it says a lot about Magnus Hedman's Celtic career is that when you mention him to a lot of people, the first thing they mention is his wife.
Yes.
Which probably says a lot about what he...
There's one other Scandinavian Celtic player who'll be discussing in another podcast that also is a topic of conversation when you mention him.
But that's Eddie for you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, he maybe that's where his fetish for players' wives came in.
Could have been.
So we've gone through the Martin O'Neill era of goalkeepers, and we've had Douglas, then Hedman, then Marshall, then back to Hedman. I actually remember of them. It reminds me of my youth when we had Dennis Cunningham, Ali Hunter, Roy Baines, Peter Latchford over the period of about 4 years playing in goals for Celtic. Obviously, Latchford then established himself, but you know, it was the same sort of principle. When you look back here, you've got Douglas, Hedman, Marshall, and in that time, you've also got Carino on the bench who played in a couple of league games but never played Champions League football. All of which were keepers that, with hindsight, you look back and say, well, he was a Celtic keeper, and you have a bit of fondness about him. But as you said earlier, none of them are keepers that you think to yourself, he was something special.
No.
So we'll part those three keepers and people's thoughts about who the best keeper was. And we'll now go on to a man who played 22 Champions League games for Celtic. Arthur Boric. What can you say about Arthur Boric?
I actually remember the first time I'd seen him was in a pre-season friendly at Leicester City. And everyone was looking forward to seeing the new signing. And the new sign everyone was looking forward to seeing was Aladier, who [S2] Yes. [S1] Was signed from Arsenal on loan. And he was a guy everybody was looking forward to seeing. And Boric had kind of came in under the radar a little bit. I think he was welcome because we all knew we needed a sort of quality goalkeeper. And he was outstanding that night, absolutely outstanding. I think within the first 5-10 minutes, he pulled off a fantastic penalty save. And he just immediately looked like the sort of goalkeeper I have, in my lifetime, had never seen at Celtic Park. He looked confident. He looked agile. And at that point, he looked athletic and throwing himself all over the place, barking out orders at the defence. He just looked outstanding. And certainly, in my lifetime, the best goalkeeper I've seen at Celtic Park. Towards the end of his career at Parkhead, obviously, he wasn't the player he was or wasn't the player he should have been. But nothing in terms of the mistakes he'd make could sort of take away from the impact he had in the fact that he was an outstanding goalkeeper.
Well, obviously, this is for people to judge and people to say who they're best goalkeeper was, but I agree with you. By some distance, Arthur Boric is the best goalkeeper I have seen playing for Celtic. By some distance. For me, he had the spring in his step that I talked about that Rab Douglas not having. He played on the balls of his feet, and you absolutely knew that he was in charge of his whole 18-yard box.
I think as well, what Celtic fans love as well is a bit of personality. And he obviously used that. And I guess towards the end of his career, it was a bit of a millstone, and he relied on that too much, really, when he was making mistakes he shouldn't have made. But he did have that sort of character, which is it's unusual for a goalkeeper to have, because it's difficult to express your personality when you're effectively rooted to the same spot for most of the game.
Yeah.
But he quickly established himself as having that personality and that charisma, and the support is quickly warm to him, but he was so much more than that. There's always a danger that he gets sort of caricatured as the holy goalie, but at his best, he was one of the best goalkeepers in the world at that time. When he was on form, it'd be pretty difficult to pick too many goalkeepers who you would have had in front of Arthur Boric.
I think you're right. I think towards the end, the problem was there was other things going on in his life,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps he was maybe a bit lazy because he could get away with being lazy at Celtic. And, you know, some people who maybe have a negative view just see, personally, with my conspiracy theories, which more and more are turning out to not be conspiracy theories, I always felt that the press hounded Arthur Boric because they wanted rid of us having a world-class player. That was my prejudicial opinion as to why he got such a hard time. They didn't like the fact that we had, in my opinion, one of Europe's best goalkeepers.
I certainly can't remember a player who, in recent years, well, probably with the exception of our current manager, who has been subject to such scrutiny from the press and media, both in terms of his actions on the pitch and also off the pitch. I mean, if you look at the whole farcical situation with him blessing himself, the fact that made front page news of a tabloid, not a tabloid, but of a broadsheet in Scotland, a supposedly quality newspaper, would suggest that your conspiracy theories got some foundation to it.
I also, you know, getting back to one of the more depressing things about Scotland, both he and Neil Lennon, who were high profile, and I'm using this in a term that helps set the tone for it, in your face Catholics,
mm-hmm.
were very much, we were told that they got what they deserved, both of them.
Yeah.
When the vitriol and criticism was being heaped upon them, well, they got what they deserved, and the only part of the sentence that was missed out was because they're just too Catholic.
The justification for a lot of the vitriol towards Boric and towards Lennon, it's almost identical. They bring it upon themselves is the classic excuse. But you don't have to dig too deep to see what the other common denominator is of the two.
Yeah, so in my opinion, I long felt probably a season and a half before he left and went downhill a wee bit, in terms of you just felt he was a wee bit lazy at times.
He probably lacked, if he had a flaw, it was probably that lack of, I guess, maturity, professionalism, where he was allowed himself to be too easily distracted by some of those actions, some of those criticisms, which unquestionably ended up being detrimental to his game and to his attitude. And consequently, that's why we saw later on in his career, he would make mistakes which would be classed as howlers by any keeper. But as I say, none of that should really detract from the quality he brought to the team. And for that, I don't know if you take a 2-year period maybe where he was just absolutely out of this world.
Yeah, and he also coincided, if you look at the first group stage where we got to the last 16 of the Champions League, which was his first season as the goalkeeper. The team was a bit of a mixture of younger players starting to come through, like McGeady, obviously McManus, we brought in Matt Wilson, and the concept that we were going to sign one or two blue chip players. So we had Thomas Gravesen, Jiří Jarasek, Jan Verygood of Hesselink.
Yeah.
Actually, the first game, which was the 3-2 away defeat to Manchester United, one of where obviously that was the one where Ryan Giggs died, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, and I remember people in the Scottish press criticising Arthur Boric for the Ryan Giggs dive, because he went out there in a fashion that allowed Giggs to dive. In terms of their, they always found something to criticise him for. But that night, I remember us playing, it was, Gordon Strachan was always liking the phrase, brave, people to be brave in possession. And that night, away to Man U in the first game, we lost 3-2. I felt we were incredibly brave in possession. It was the first time in European football, I felt, where under pressure, our plan A wasn't hoof it up the other end of the park. I remember us playing, I remember in particular one occasion, Jarasek, Gravesen and Lennon playing a wee triangle. Like, we were under pressure from Man United at the edge of our box, and they played a triangle of passes, very quick passes to move the ball out, and just being absolutely amazed that we were playing this way. And although Arthur Boric let in three goals that night, I was at the game. I don't recall blaming him for any of it. I just remember being really angry that Ryan Giggs was not the upstanding fine gentleman that he was made out to be. And of course, subsequently, it was found out that he's a cheat in his personal life as well as his football life.
I think the scapegoat that night for me was probably Gravesen. Did he not? Did he not give away a cheap ball at the edge of the area just before? I can't remember which goal it was now, but I remember it was a couple of times in the game where, partly because, as you say, we were actually trying to keep possession, to try and play away sort of.
I think it was their third goal.
Yeah.
Because we'd made it 1-0, they'd made it 1-1, then they'd made it 2-1, then Nakamura's free kick had made it 2-2.
That's right.
Then I'm sure, because it was the far end of the, it was the far end of the pitch to me, so it must have been the second half, and it was 2-2 at half time. So it was Solskjaer scored in the 47th minute, and I'm sure it was Gravesen gave away really cheap possession at the edge of the box.
Yeah. But as you say, that was, I guess, partly due to the way we tried to play that night, which was certainly untypical of previous away performances in Europe, where we'd been more direct, I would say. I wouldn't say I hate the sort of O'Neill team being labelled long ball when we were never anything of the sort, but we were certainly more direct under O'Neill, and then under Strachan that night, certainly we did try and play a way out a bit more. And looking back at the goals, obviously the penalty, Boric was blamed in the media for it, but blameless for me, and I can't remember anything about the other two goals which would suggest he was at fault. And of course, in the return match, which is, I still remembered for Naka's free kick, a brilliant penalty save from...
Well, that was just absolutely unbelievable, because obviously Naka's free kick was incredible. It was a copycat of what he'd done against Manchester United in the game we've just been talking about.
Yeah.
And then for them to get a penalty, that it was one of those occasions where you're thinking, I remember my initial reaction was I thought he was pointing for a goal kick. And then suddenly realising he was pointing for a penalty. And you just thought, that is just such a big team decision that he's given. He's found an opportunity to get Manchester United an equaliser in this game.
It felt like at that time, it felt like you'd got up after Nakamura's free kick, it felt like you'd got up on Christmas morning, had got the thing you'd always wanted, gone for your breakfast and come back and you'd been burgled. That's what it felt like at that time when that penalty was awarded, because it was just, I mean, I guess you might argue for it if that penalty had been awarded for you, but at the time, as you say, it just looked like such a big team decision. I remember a free kick was fired at the wall, hit somebody in the wall, and then the next thing, he'd pointed at the spot. But I would say that Boric's save probably even eclipsed the elation of Naka's free kick.
Because you just suddenly thought, that's it. And the other thing I vividly remember at the end of the game, working out we were through.
Yeah.
And nobody was, and the stadium didn't, we didn't do this, you know, like London Calling or anything like that. And then I get the train home and I've gone down to the station and guys were talking about, well, all we need to do is go and get a result in Copenhagen. And they were talking about this for about 2 or 3 minutes and I thought, I can't have an answer to this. And I said, no, we're through. No, we're not through, because they're talking on the radio, Radio Clyde, and I think on the television they were also talking about what Celtic needs to do. No, they're talking on the radio, we need to do this. And I was saying, no, because it's head-to-head. It's not goal difference, it's not this. And trying to talk them through, I can't even remember what they were now, all the permutations and saying, but if this happens and if that happens, and if that happens, then that means that they will have to have lost and we won't be, you know, and you're going through all those. And so, again, my frustration of that group stage was we were through. And we went to Copenhagen and you thought, right, they're a Danish team. We should be able to beat them away from home. Plus, we're already through, so the pressure's off.
Yeah.
And we lost 3-1.
Yeah, another really, it was a really disappointing performance. As you say, you thought an ideal opportunity to get that monkey off our back, and if anything, we compounded it, we had a pretty dire performance.
But then after that was our first taste of Champions League last 16 football.
Yeah.
We drew 0-0 in Milan.
Yeah.
Obviously, the AC Milan version of the podcast we are doing tonight, they would have to include Maldini in their list of great goalkeepers because of the save he pulled off in the San Siro that stopped us going through to the last eight of the Champions League.
Yeah.
Again, Boric clean sheet at Celtic Park, and again, clean sheet away in Milan over 90 minutes, and it was only an extra time that...
The Kaká went through and scored. That was a hard one to take as well. But, you know, both those performances, home and away, Boric was excellent. And it was an excellent team performances in both games, really. And nobody could have grumbled if we'd gone through to the last eight.
No, and, you know, in many ways we deserved it, but... No, it wasn't to be. And then our next round of Champions League fixtures, we again had another last 16 journey and had Milan and Shakhtar and Benfica in our group. Another comfortable away from home defeat to Shakhtar.
2-0 first game of a campaign, wasn't it?
2-0 down after 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Typical away from home nonsense. Beat Milan 2-1 at Celtic Park. Lost in Benfica 1-0. And then beat Benfica at Celtic Park 1-0.
I thought we were particularly unlucky in Lisbon. I remember Boric had a couple of good saves that night. And did Faye not nick it in the last 5 minutes?
87th minute.
Yeah, that was a hard one to take. And I think, if I remember rightly, it was probably a Caldwell error. I don't know.
It was. I have it in my head it was a Caldwell error. Even if it wasn't, let's just say it was a Caldwell error. And then, of course, we finished second in the group by the amazing last-minute goal from Massimo Donati.
Donati, yeah.
And I suppose special mention for that, although it's not in the group stages, special mention for that night must go to Arthur Boric and his penalty save against Spartak Moscow in the qualifying game.
Yeah, definitely. The night of the jazz hands.
Yes, the night of the jazz hands, exactly. Do you know, I still to this, I know exactly what was going on, and it was just one of those things where he was so deliriously happy, he just didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And actually, the benefit of being a striker is somebody jumps on top of you after 2 seconds. As a goalkeeper and all these colleagues that are at the halfway line, he's deliriously happy waiting for them to get half the length of a pitch, and he's just running around not knowing what to do. And then, of course, we had our 4-2 aggregate defeat to Barcelona.
Yeah.
But that was just, we were playing a team who were better than us.
Yeah, that Barca team were pretty exceptional as well. It's quite interesting, really. You know, lots made about Celtic goalkeepers and the need for concentration, obviously domestically, because you'll be playing for long periods where you might not have to do much. And obviously the keepers have to then go from that environment into the Champions League, where they're playing a totally different class of opponent. And, you know, the goalkeeper's game would have to change to match that step up in opposition. And Boric seemed to revel in that. He seemed, you know, he was in that environment where he was busier, suited him more than, I think, the domestic games, where it was probably where his concentration wasn't his strongest point. But he did seem to revel in that high-intensity Champions League environment against that top quality opposition. I think that's where he really showed himself to be a top class keeper.
Yeah, I suppose we've probably gone through enough about Arthur Boric. I think we've demonstrated in the next group stage that I don't really want to talk about, because it was the other one that sort of slips from my mind whenever I talk about Champions League football for Celtic, where we also finished last in the group because we couldn't beat Aalborg home or away. And we lost away 2-1 and drew 0-0 at Celtic Park, which is a pretty disgraceful stuff against Danish champions. So we'll gloss over Aalborg, but that's Arthur Boric with 22 Champions League games. And then we talked about Arthur leaving, and then we have our next group of Champions League games, and the man who played all 8 of the group and then the 2 qualifying games, Fraser Foster, who for me is the only realistic challenger to Arthur Boric as the goalkeeper for the Champions League 11.
Realistically, there's only two candidates, really. I've always been a big fan of Fraser Foster. He has his critics, but for me, he's got all the physical attributes to be a really top quality goalkeeper. And for the most part, he shows those qualities. He has weaknesses in his game, which I don't think he's improved as much as I would have liked. He's still not particularly good with his feet, and his command of his area is not what it should be for a guy his size, and the decision making sometimes on the cross ball is poor. But he's still a young guy, and he's a guy who's still learning his trade. And from what I understand, there's nobody at Celtic Park who works as hard in training as what he does. And I think he's got the potential to be a world class performer. But there's a tendency at the moment that he seems to be a bit of a fall guy at times, when even on Sunday he was getting Saturday he was getting a bit of stick for the Hearts goal, where I thought he was a bit unsighted and really should have been questioning why the ball wasn't closed down a bit quicker at the edge of the box. But I think he's an outstanding goalkeeper on his game, and he proved that in the Champions League last season.
Yeah, and like you, I can remember being on a podcast with a guy who used to do this called Eddie Pearson, and discussing Foster in his first season when there was debate about when he was on loan and whether we were going to sign him. And I felt, and I remember commenting that I thought he was very Rab Douglas-esque, a big guy who filled the goal, but there was no, he wasn't on the balls of his feet, there was no spring in his step, he wasn't athletic, and he didn't command his area. Now, where I was prepared to give him more slack for that was he was young, and so, you know, you've got to start shouting at and bawling at guys who are 10, 12 years older than you, because we had Mistorovic at the back at the time. You've got to boss them around, and that's a difficult thing for a young guy to come and do.
I think as well, it's a goalkeeper will always benefit if he's got a settled defence in front of him and a settled defensive partnership in front of him, who's managed to build up an understanding with. I'm not really sure he's had that at his time. We've had quite an exchange of personnel in the back over the last couple of seasons, and I don't think that benefits him. I think if we were to have a more settled centre-half partnership, he would benefit from that, and just in the sense of knowing who was responsible and for balls into the box or whatever, because sometimes you'll get a defender who will go and attack every ball, and over time you'll get one who'll stand off and stay with his man. So I think he would improve as well if he had that settled back line in front of him.
Yeah, and I did think last season and the season before he was starting to improve. His decision-making about when to leave his line and when to stay seemed to be starting to greatly improve. And obviously, one of his greatest nights as a Celtic goalkeeper was the 2-1 defeat last season in the group stages away to Barcelona. You know, obviously, their last goal was virtually the last kick of the game. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, I suppose you could argue that with the final few seconds on the clock, a ball coming in towards a 6-yard box, a guy at 6'7" should come in and, you know, clear everybody out of the way, grab it and take it. The ball was whipped in with a bit more pace. I always remember, you know, it's one of those goals that you watch over and over again, and every time I watch it, I always think that Ambrose nearly cleared that. He was probably about half a centimetre away from clearing it with his head. It just skimmed over his head. And five, maybe 20 minutes earlier, he'd have cleared it because he would have had more spring in his step.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it would be picky to say that he should have come and taken that, because the rest of the night he was just absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, I think that was as good a performance as we've ever seen from a goalkeeper, from a Celtic goalkeeper in Europe, including Boric.
Yeah,
it was
maybe on a par with David Marshall's game away at Barcelona.
Yeah,
when I just remember, I actually remember standing in the Nou Camp and turning to Neil McCallum from our site and saying, "I can't believe it. Have we actually found a goalkeeper?" David Marshall that night. If you remember when Ronaldinho was clean through on goal, skipped through past our whole defence,
mm-hmm.
and Marshall dived down and grabbed the ball off his toes.
Yeah.
And then had some absolutely outstanding saves that night. That was obviously, that was David Marshall's finest hour. I think, unfortunately, getting back to David Marshall for a moment, Martin O'Neill's comments after that night, I know it was the UEFA Cup and not the Champions League, but Martin O'Neill's comments that night were quite prophetic when he said that David Marshall should retire because he would never ever have a better night and would never be able to perform that well. And I think subsequently that might have been the case.
And I think that you kind of sum up the difference there between Marshall and what I think Fraser Forster is capable of, because I can see Forster in future repeating that level of performance, and he's another one who I think will probably revel in the Champions League environment. As we were saying, his weakness under the crossballs and in the decision making, it's not as important in the Champions League, primarily because you're not playing teams who are hitting high balls into a box as regularly as what you'd get in the SPL. And in some respects, it plays the type of football we come up against in the Champions League plays to Marshall's strengths. It plays to Fraser Forster's strengths. So if you were to judge him on that one campaign, he was outstanding. But
the only thing I would say in throwing your David Marshall style statistics back at you, not quite as bad, but in 8 games he conceded 13 goals.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, his record is as the goalkeeper of a team that drew, won, lost. So he had our first, he was the goalkeeper who was in our first away Champions League victory.
Yeah.
And wasn't massively at fault in the Benfica away defeat, the 2-1 defeat in Benfica. And actually, I remember him having nothing to do at home to Spartak. Really. I remember Ambrose getting turned all over the place a couple of times.
Yeah. Even I'm trying to wipe it out of my memory, but the Juventus game, I guess he wasn't at that level what he'd been at in the group stage.
Yep.
But again, I would say the fault sort of lay elsewhere. And funnily enough, probably the home game against Juventus was a much better performance than the scorelines suggested.
I think my own gut feel is that Arthur Boric had more outstanding games than mm-hmm. Fraser Forster, but what you can say about Forster, he's a young keeper. I think there's more spotlight is coming on Forster because people are now starting to look at him saying, well, he is actually one of England's best 3 or 4 goalkeepers. So I think people are maybe slightly harsh, certainly the media, are slightly harsher on him at times because, well, one of England's top 3 or 4 goalkeepers shouldn't be flapping in that circumstance or should be in more control in that circumstance. And that's a bit of a compliment that you can pay to him. He's still only, 23, 24?
I mean, there's no doubt he's made mistakes and his decision-making still poor. I remember, I think it was the first game against Karagandy where he punched a ridiculous ball when it was straight into his hands to catch. But if he can eradicate that sort of that element to his game, then his potential is immense. Really, I honestly think that he's got the physical attributes to go to the very top. What he would need really in terms of if he was to be a contender for this team is to have that longevity of what Boric had and to turn one good campaign into 3 or 4 good campaigns. And hopefully he'll do it this year for us as well.
Well, this year he's got, once again, he's got to go back to the new camp and have them back here. He's got to go to the San Siro. And he's got to go to the Amsterdam Arena. So he's revisiting grounds that Arthur Boric excelled in, mm-hmm. grounds that he excelled in, and getting back to Rab Douglas. I know, again, it's a qualifying and not part of our thing. When we beat Ajax 3-1,
yeah,
and Shota Avalanche scored the one goal for them that gave him a bit of hope, I always felt that was a wee bit of a... It was one of the things that I felt was sort of... If Rab Douglas had a fault, if you hit a low shot to him, he parried it out back out to the middle of the penalty area. As opposed to pushing it wide, he parried it out. And that's why Ajax scored in that 3-1 game in Amsterdam. But as I say, that doesn't count for what we are doing because it's not a Champions League game, group game. It was a qualifying game.
The other thing I'd say about Forster is that not... Although he has been prone to the odd mistake, I would say in comparison with Boric, that his Forster's mistakes haven't been as costly as some of Arthur's. When Boric, towards the end of his time at Celtic Park, made some mistakes, they tended to be real howlers throwing the ball into the goals. Whereas as Forster's mistakes have tended to be flapping or coming for balls he shouldn't have come. But generally we've got away with most of them. Whereas with some of Arthur's proved to be quite costly.
Yeah, you're right. And much as I'm not a Gordon Smith fan, I do remember once when he was a pundit before he was a director of a football club that went bust. Him making what I thought was a relevant comment about how to choose a goalkeeper, and his way of rating a goalkeeper was how many mistakes they would make in how many games. So, for example, his example was he would refer to Andy Gorham as a 1 in 20. So you would make one mistake that costs you something every 20 games. Whereas an average SPL goalkeeper might be a 1 in 8 or a 1 in 9. And it's mistakes that cost you games. So I suppose from that perspective, Fraser Forster has got a pretty high ratio of his one in whatever. But he's got, almost certainly, unless he picks up an injury, he's got another 6 Champions League games, so he'll be on 14. He'll be 8 short of Arthur by the end of this campaign in the group stages, and you never know. Obviously, there might be some last 16 or maybe even last 8 action after that. I think if we get out of this group stage and get to into the last 16, I think we're capable of getting to the last 8. I don't know about you.
Looking at the group, I'm unusually confident, which is, I don't know, is a good thing or a bad thing. I think we can surprise a few this year again, starting with Wednesday night, hopefully. And you know, I think last season's last 16 result was not at all reflective of the performances over the two legs.
And you know, the Juventus game last season, I can still remember at half time us discussing that if we get a goal, we could still go across to Italy with a lead.
Yeah.
At half time.
And you feel once you're out of that group stage, you know, If we can get into the last 16, having progressed from a group with Barcelona, Milan and Ajax, and there's absolutely no reason then we can't progress further to the last 8. So
no, and that's why I say I look at this season's group and I think if we're capable of getting into the last 16, we're capable of getting into the last 8.
Yes.
Because if we're capable of finishing ahead of two of AC Milan and Ajax, and Barcelona, so two of them we'll be ahead of, then we're capable of getting to the last 8. Anyway, we were here to talk about the goalkeepers, Champions League, so people have got to choose from Rab Douglas with his 6 Champions League performances, Magnus Hedman with his 8 Champions League performances over 2 different campaigns, 6 in 03-04, and then 2 in the second half of 04-05. David Marshall on his 4 Champions League campaigns. Arthur Boric on his 22. And Fraser Forster on his 8, which was last season's campaign. 6 in the group stage and then the 2 games against Juventus. So people can make a decision on who they think the best goalkeeper is from that. I think I'm going to be joined by you again in a later podcast where we talk about the best games of the Champions League.
Yeah.
We have talked about quite a few of them just now, but we've been trying to talk about them in reference to the goalkeepers, so these would be people's memories and what really sticks in your mind about the game. So I look forward to speaking to you about that later, and thanks for going through the keepers.
No problem, Harry. Thanks very much for asking us on.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that rundown of the famous number ones. I'm sure, I know they didn't have much squad numbers before you chuck in. The famous number ones of Celtic through the Champions League group stages. It lasted nearly around 20 minutes, so it was a bit longer than I expected with the brief selection. So I'll need to make sure that we don't go on and on at the same per capita rate for the defenders and midfielders. Otherwise, it'll be a four-hour podcast. If you can let me know who your best keeper was, obviously with Douglas on 6, Hedman on 8, David Marshall on 4 appearances, and then Arthur on 22 and Fraser Foster on 8, you can drop me an email to harrybradycu@gmail.com. You can tweet me, harrybradycu, or if you're listening to this on the site just now, just scroll down to the bottom and stick on comments. You might want to either just let me know who your best goalkeeper was, or if you can let me know the whole team, or you can just wait until everybody has, we've gone through the keepers, defenders, midfielders, strikers and managers, and then what the best game was. And after all that, on the last podcast, I'll say when the final date is for voting for who the best player was, and then we will do a pen pick on each one as we go through on the site, as we go through our Champions League 11 for Celtic. Next week's podcast, we'll have the defenders. There'll be a few more to choose from, but to give you a flavour of who's going to be involved, it'll be Van Haren with his 10 appearances, then Bobo Baldi, who was on 19. Barsteen McManus, our most played defender. Then Mialbi, McNamara, Varga, Gray, Stuart Gray, Mark Wilson, Paul Telfer, Caddis on 1 appearance, Gary Caldwell on 18. Miraculously, Stephen Presley just the one. Stephen McManus, as I say, 22. Lee Naylor, 18. Daniel D, 3. Pierre Doumbé on 1. John Kennedy, 3. Hinkle, 4. Luvins, 2. Matthews, 2. Izaguirre, 6. Two players who played the whole of this last 16 and the two last 16 games in the whole of the group stages last season. Kelvin Wilkes on 8, and of course, Charles McGrew on 8. Mikael Lustig on 7, and Ambrose on 6. If you want to be controversial, you could stick and decide that Didier Gat, who we've got in our midfielder section, is a defender and stick him in. Or you could decide that Jackie Mack wants to be, and Charles McGrew want to be in your midfielder team. It's up to you, just as long as you make it clear of what the team is when you're submitting it, and we can take it from there. So we've got AC Milan, hopefully, coming up by the time I've downloaded this. The hopefully bit is that you get to listen to it before that game. And hopefully some of the players who are in our team might be heroes and we get a result in Milan. Here's hoping. Cheers and thanks for downloading Celtic Underground Podcast number 200A, because we're going to B, C, D, E, maybe F, can't remember, from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady saying goodnight.